Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Martin Luther King Day is a complicated holiday. We celebrate the life of a towering figure in American history, even as we mourn its violent end. When we acknowledge the victories of those who have fought fearlessly for justice and tolerance, we must also recognize the fact that race is still a significant factor in the extent to which each one of us can expect to be treated fairly in the workforce, the education system, the media, and the criminal justice system. This is Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. As a New Yorker raised in Nigeria, Teju Cole has an interesting perspective on all this. He has written that his race attracts glances in New York, in India, in Europe, anywhere he has been, in fact, outside of Africa. And the meaning and weight of race in the modern world is one of the subjects he's explored in work as a photographer, writer, professor, and cultural critic. He writes regularly for The New Yorker and The New York Times and is the author of the novels Open City and Every Day is for the Thief. He's in town to speak tonight at the Martin Luther King Jr. Symposium presented by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Teju, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You were born in the U.S. but raised in Nigeria.
That's right.
Did you travel back and forth a lot as a kid?
Almost never.
Almost never.
In fact, I only came to the U.S. once when I was a kid after I had returned to Nigeria. I was 10 years old. I came for, I think, a two-week vacation, 2 weeks in Michigan, and then I went back and didn't see the U.S. again or indeed leave Africa again until I was 17 years old.
Were you drawn to return to the United States in part because it was part of your personal story that you had been born here?
Yes, I think that was an important part of it. But it was also at the very beginning of the 90s. Mm-hmm. And Nigeria was going through kind of a tough time economically in terms of the government and all that. And, I mean, we had lots of universities, but my folks felt I could do better by coming to the U.S. to study.
When did you realize that some cultures use race as a way of classifying people, of making assumptions about who someone might be?
I mean, the fundamental knowledge is sort of there for everyone. It's mm-hmm. you know about there's racism, there's sort of slavery, there's discrimination, and of course, everybody around the world knows some of the brief elements of the civil rights movement. But coming to the United States as an African, I have to say it took me a while to understand how this reality registered for me personally. After all, I was able to move and function in these spaces as a clever young lad from Africa and do well at school and maybe at the very beginning feel even that racial struggle had nothing to do with me. And now I understand that it has everything to do with me, both in terms of the people who cleared the way and secured the privileges I'm now able to enjoy as somebody whose life is here, but also in terms of the ongoing struggles that we have, that there's a collective we at work, that whether you're an African-American who's always lived here or American from Africa who came in some later way, or some complicated mix of those two things. Your race is on your body, and America will make you think about it and have to deal with it.
You've been here, obviously, for decades now, but I wonder if when you first got here, it took you a while to realize that to understand American culture, you would also have to explore this kind of subculture of African-American culture that is something entirely American and yet unique for the people who experience it from within.
That's right. I mean, and that took a while. I mean, it was there in a much more organic form in terms of the arts. For example, I really always cared about John Coltrane from my first year of college. You know, Miles Davis mattered a lot. In Nigeria, I'd watched shows like, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and A Different World.
It's so realistic, right?
Yeah, I mean, it told me everything I needed to know about America. You know, right, Aunt Viv? And so all of those things were part of my life. But to understand them as these sort of vital structural interventions in what America defined itself as, to understand that contemporary American culture was not only indebted to black culture, but it was actually founded on it. Rock and roll and jazz and blues and hip-hop and everything that everybody in this country considered really cool had a black element in it. That took years to understand that. But it takes time when you're in a place to see why it is how it is.
It's interesting when you see people from outside black culture appropriating aspects of it, because on the one hand, that can be read as a kind of, you know, homage. On the other hand, it can be, you know, as you've said, you know, people want everything except the struggle, right? They want everything except all the disadvantage that comes with it, which essentially nullifies the idea that you are taking everything because this is such a big part of it.
That's right. I mean, there's definitely that element of everything but the burden.
Right.
So I would say one of the fundamental facts of American life today is that, you know, when Kanye drops a new album or Kendrick or Beyonce, a big part of that readership of the audience, of the listenership, is young white kids living in suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're the ones who largely go on to shape what this country does and is in the future. Everybody in this country, white kids, brown kids, Asian, Latino, and of course black kids, everyone is being weaned on black culture, which is what makes it even more urgent to understand where it comes from, what it is doing, and what our mutual responsibilities are to each other. I mean, integration is such a profound fact of everyday life that when you get into those spaces that are insufficiently integrated, it is bizarre. You know, when you walk into churches that are just sort of one race, or corporate environments, or, you know, the places where money and power and influence are circulating, in all of those spaces, it is a kind of a staggering artificiality, because in reality, in our lives, in the ways in which as Americans we live and move and have our being, it is culturally deeply integrated.
You have written beautifully about the novelist James Baldwin, an African-American who traveled in Europe in the 1950s. Can you talk about some of the similarities, simply of the circumstances of your life and of his that are most interesting to you?
Yeah. Well, Baldwin, of course, is just really, I don't want to say he's one of the great American writers, because he's one of the great Americans.
Full stop.
Full stop. And he's one of the great writers. Full stop. And certainly I'm not going to reduce him all the way to say, oh, he's one of the great black writers, because he certainly is that. But he is one of the great Americans. And what makes him great is his honesty, his openness to experience, the clarity of his moral vision, as well as the clarity of his political questions. He's not interesting to us because he knew everything, but because he was available for the questions. When I started to think more about him and write more about him, you know, I realized that there was someone like myself, actually, who, and as a very young man, had been really caught up in the fervor of the church. And I think I'm going to be very careful not to compare myself to James Baldwin, but I think for both of us, the oratorical splendor, the rhetoric of the church, was something that seeded our later participation in the work of literature.
That's interesting that you say that, because it's more than just that kind of oratorical splendor. Is more than simply the words. They matter a lot, but it's also the cadence that really draws you in.
It's cadences. It's lyricism. It's about specificity of vocabulary as well as delivery, which is why I value Baldwin so much. As an essay writer, also, because his work contains both monumentality and what in an earlier age would have been called bidding in the sense of persuasion. So I learned a lot of that from him. And not last year now, 2 years ago, I happened to be in Switzerland. I was spending some time in Switzerland. And one of the reasons I was keen to be in Switzerland was because there was a story about Baldwin I knew, mm-hmm. where he had gone to a Swiss village.
Stranger in the Village.
Yes. He wrote an essay about it later called Stranger in the Village. He goes up to this Swiss village in a remote part of a small country in the middle of Europe. And he says, by all accounts, I was the first black person they had ever seen in this village. And then he tells this funny but painful but funny, gives this account of being in that village and how it gave him a way to think about race relations in the U.S., how the relatively innocent racism of these villagers who were pulling his hair and saying, you know, why doesn't he grow his hair out and make himself a coat for the winter, and wondering if he was the one stealing firewood, how their relatively innocent racism.
Innocent to the extent that they don't have a history of acting on it.
Exactly. And innocent in the sense of kids on the street running away from him and all of this stuff. Racism is never innocent. Let's say unelaborated mm-hmm. racism helped him understand the much more insidious forms of it that were happening in the U.S. in the 50s. And so I went back to that same village.
I want to have you pause there because I need to take a quick break here, and I want to have plenty of time to talk to you about this. So
great.
Hold on just
we'll
a minute.
We'll talk more about it.
My guest is Teju Cole. He is a photographer, novelist, and cultural critic. His novels include Open City and Every Day is for the Thief. He's in town to speak tonight at the Martin Luther King Jr. Symposium presented by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New Yorker and New York Times contributor Teju Cole. He's also a photographer, novelist, and cultural critic, and a professor at Bard College. He's in town to speak tonight at the Martin Luther King Jr. Symposium presented by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. So you had a residency in Switzerland.
That's right.
And you went to the exact village that James Baldwin
was. Yeah, and it wasn't even all that easy to get to either. You know, there was a train and then a bus, a train, another train, a bus, and then, you know, a bit of a walk way up in the mountains and in a town called Leukerbad. And that was where Baldwin had come a few times to spend the winters and write the book that became Go Tell It on the Mountain. But when he wrote the essay about his experience as the only black man that they had ever seen in this village, he used it as a way to think about what was going on in the States, about the more insidious forms of racism that the United States had developed. I went there in 2014, and this was when we were just getting into the first intense phase of Black Lives Matter. So it became an opportunity for me not only to do some close reading of this great essay, this heartfelt essay, but to also begin to think also for myself about where is this country going as far as race relations, police brutality, what I call systematic disregard of black experience. So all these years on, James Baldwin is still a terrific help to us and to me.
One of the things that you noted, although you were certainly not the second black person in that village, there had been mm-hmm. others before you, but you did feel conspicuous in a certain way because of the color of your skin. Surely it was a different experience than Baldwin felt. But I wonder how strange it is if you go back home and visit Nigeria And, you know, if someone catches your eye across a restaurant, if you have to recalibrate and think, okay, this person is probably not looking at me because I'm a black man sitting in this restaurant, because that is a, you know, a black man sitting in this restaurant.
That's right. But, you know, believe it or not, even those of us who are black can go some stretches of time and not remember that our skin is a particular color. You might go half your day, for example, and not remember what your hair color is or your race or, you know, or your gender until somebody rudely or nicely reminds you of it in some context or the other. Our race is one of those facts of our lives. There's no denying it, and there's no wish to deny it. But it is also not the only place where we dwell.
Right.
We exist in the world in so many interesting and complicated ways. I suppose this is sometimes the reason that racism is painful, is that it can be a rude shock and reminder that really, once again, you know, are you reminding me of that again? Something that is really to have prejudice extended towards you on account of your race is not only difficult and painful, it feels pointless. In the 70s, Toni Morrison described racism as a supreme waste of time.
That's a great sentence, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just wasting your time because you've got things to do. So so if I'm in an all-black environment, somebody looks at me, obviously there's nothing race. You know, they might think, oh, I'm that rap star. Or they might think I'm me. They might recognize me, or it might be somebody I went to school with.
Are you often mistaken for a rap star?
Sometimes I am, but let's not go into who in particular. But if it's a white person, or if it's in an unfamiliar place, there's a way in which one knows what a glance means that is hard to convey in words. As a woman, if a man looks at you in a threatening way, it's hard to put it into words, but you know, you always know. And as a black person, if somebody looks at me in a way that is calculated to convey to me that he or she thinks they're superior to me on account of my being black and they're not being black, I know right away. Mm-hmm. It becomes a kind of sort of native knowledge that one has, and it's a waste of time.
It's a fascinating way to describe it that I hadn't conceived of before. I was thinking a lot about this. I think one of the things that makes these conversations so difficult is that I can't speak for all white people. I am a white woman. One of the things that's hard, I think, for white people who don't wish to be racist or biased in some way is that they feel the burden of people who are sort of very visibly racist and very openly hateful, and they think, well, I am not that person, and so it's really easy to say I have no complicity. My existence in this society means I have no complicity in the horrible things that happen to other people.
Right. The previous Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, when he began his term, made a very startling comment. He said, this country is cowardly about race. And everyone just sort of took three steps back and said, oh, my goodness, that was the Attorney General who said that. You know, and in his own way, you know, there's certainly complaints can be made. But in his own way, he worked to think through some of those issues in his official capacity. Maybe not enough, but more than many of his predecessors. We are cowardly in talking about race, in part because if we're doing fine where we are, we don't want extra heat of getting it wrong. But in order to stand up for what's right and to be with each other the way we ought to be, we have to take that risk. We have to be courageous about race, even if we risk getting it wrong. It would be a monumental mistake for any white person in the U.S. to say that they don't benefit from racism. I know that you can be white and poor. You can be white and deeply dispossessed. And you can be white and just new on the American scene, so your ancestors weren't here. And you can be non-black and not white and still benefit from anti-blackness? How do you benefit from it? Because the railroads, the roads, the Capitol, the White House, the things that were built by unpaid labor of black people.
For centuries.
It's like asking a man, you know, a man who says, well, you know, I don't do anything misogynist, so I don't benefit from patriarchy. Yes, but, you know, women are passed over. And all the, I called racism a waste of time. Misogyny is a waste of time. All the time that women spend having to deal with the side effects of patriarchy, that's free time for guys, you know. And all the time that non-black people spend living their lives, that a black person has to spend just sort of undoing the tangle of racist actions in the present as well as in the past, means that there is an aggregate advantage to not being black. There's an aggregate advantage to being a man instead of a woman. There's an aggregate advantage to being straight instead of gay. And these are the ways that prejudice this is the way it functions. It's not simply just the prejudice. It's the room that it frees up for people who are not under that prejudicial situation.
To the extent that we all, in different ways, share a collective oppression, a burden, or a collective advantage, it takes me back briefly to something that you had a sort of dialogue with Baldwin about, which is that he had this great love of these sort of classical traditions of Western literature and art and music and loved them very much, but had to sort of hold himself back and say, but these are not my stories. This is not my legacy. And you pushed back on that idea, or at least you were able to do so in the 20-teens.
A little bit, you know. I think it's worth understanding that things were different in the 80s than they are now. And things were certainly different in the 60s than they were now and in the 50s. And Baldwin's experience is similar to mine in certain ways as being really a black male body functioning in the American system and all the complications that come with simply being the possessor of a black male body. But in certain other ways, some things are much easier for me. The fact that I grew up in Africa makes some things easier for me.
What does that mean?
It means that I am ineluctably adopted into the line of American blackness, but I am adopted into it. I'm born into it by the fact of my birth in this country. But since I grew up in Africa, I returned and I was adopted into it because I came back to this country with a different set of cultural codes. And it is different if you have that through, what shall I call it? I don't want to call it natural birth, simply because of all the talk about such and such a person's citizenship and their eligibility. But let's just say through the natural line of being the descendant of enslaved people on this land, your experience of blackness will also be different. And therefore, one of the things that is not said often enough in this country is that all forms of black Americanness are necessarily complicated, but they're not all the same.
Do you think that the nature of the black American, African American experience will change a great deal as we start to see larger percentages of immigrants coming from countries in Africa and other places in the world who don't have that, you know, legacy of having enslaved ancestors? Some of them, of course, do, depending on where they're from, but some don't.
In some ways, it's true, and in some ways, it actually does not really matter because when a cop stops me and decides to get...
He doesn't ask who your grandpa was.
He does not care whether I'm from Kingston, Jamaica, or from Lagos, Nigeria, or from Detroit, Michigan. All he knows is that, you know, there's some black dude in that car, or, you know, God forbid, there's three black dudes in that car, they must be up to no good. Hmm. So in some ways, it does not really matter at all. It doesn't. You cannot be like some African immigrants are who say, well, we're not like those African Americans. Well, actually, you are, you know, indeed and in fact. But in some other ways, there are these interesting layers of complication, because now, how shall I put it? The cathedral of black Americanness grows ever larger. It becomes an ever bigger church with many more voices and many more choirs and many more echoes within that space. And its shadow, therefore, over the American experience itself gets ever larger. And so we have, you know, you have people like Jidenna or Wale, Sade, or Seal, all of whom are Nigerian, actually. You've got people like Colin Powell, you know, from the West Indies, Barack Obama, whose family, part of his family is from Kenya. This is part of the American story. It is a real part of the American story, you know. There are people whose parents come from the Caribbean, but they grew up here. But then the Caribbean is still part of who they are, but so is the U.S. And that's a complication I think that black people are aware of and embrace. And maybe for people outside the black community, there can be an element of, oh, they're all the same. But we're not all the same. We're all the same and all different in interesting ways that make this country much more interesting.
Teju Cole is my guest. His novels are Open City and Every Day is for the Thief. He's a contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times, and he'll be speaking tonight at the Martin Luther King Jr. Symposium presented by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. We'll be talking a little bit about photography when we come back to the conversation. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist, cultural critic, photographer, and Professor Teju Cole. He's in town to speak tonight at the Martin Luther King Jr. Symposium presented by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You wrote last year about photography and the civil rights movement, and I have to say one thing that has stuck with me that I cannot get out of my head is the fact that photographic equipment and film emulsions were calibrated to be really good at capturing white skin tones, and not so good, perhaps not intentionally, but nobody thought about it at the time who was doing these things, at capturing, you know,
black skin
variations in darker skin.
Yeah, well, let me answer that by some very brief personal experience. From time, I travel a lot, and from time to time, I'll be in an airport. Somebody might just so stand in front of me. I say in an airport because for some reason that's where it happens. It happened three times. Stands in front of me and I say, you know, I'm the kind of guy, I see something, I have to say something. And I say, hey, well, like, you know, excuse me, I'm standing here. And, you know, he or she will say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. And, you know, under my breath, I might say, yeah, I know. I know you didn't, you know. Sometimes the way race plays out is, I'm sorry I didn't see you. When Kodak makes these Shirley cards, the cards that are used to calibrate whether a particular photo has been exposed properly, a particular negative, it makes them based on the skin of a white model. Emulsions made on the film are calibrated to make white skin look good. I don't think anybody at Kodak sat down back then, whenever it was in the 40s or something, and say, well, now we're going to, you know, unfold our nefarious racist plan. No. A great deal of racism is disregard.
People just didn't consider that they should think about.
I just didn't see you. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole bunch of black people in this country, but I don't imagine them as part of our, you know, target audience. which is why the necessity of somebody then coming out and articulating these things and making noise about it and making noise about the necessity of our inclusion is so important. And it happened with photography. When you first say, well, cameras are kind of racist, it sounds silly. But in so many ways, as I wrote in that article, the whole structure of photography was designed around the needs of white customers. And so in a quite passive process, photography ended up being quite racist, so that brilliant black photographers like Gordon Parks and Roy DeCarava had to find ways of working around the limitations of the equipment and the supplies in the photographic industry.
I want to talk about Roy DeCarava because you draw a sort of direct line between him and the work of cinematographer Bradford Young.
That's right. So Bradford Young was a cinematographer on the movie Selma, and he did an interesting thing in that film, which he did in an earlier film as well, a film called Mother of George, which is that the lighting was low. If you've seen that film, you'll notice how sort of inky and velvety many of the scenes are. Many scenes happen at night or in interiors. The skin of the actor playing Martin Luther King, David Oyelowo, is already dark, and he makes it even darker by lighting it quite low. Roy DeCarava, a photographer active in the 60s, 70s, in 50s, 60s, 70s, used to take pictures where black skin was even blacker. But he was able, through his technical ability, to make the black skin look really black without a loss of detail. All of that information was still in there. And so you feel that, like in our culture, in this country, for example, when we want to make somebody look bad, you know, like the O.J. Simpson cover.
Right.
Or it happened
where he was artificially darkened.
Mm-hmm. Or Obama, there's been a story that came out that John McCain in 2008 consistently used, in attack ads, used a darker, a sort of filter to make Obama's skin look blacker, because studies had also found that voters would distance themselves from somebody who looked even darker. Okay, so you see all of that rubbish happening, and you decide as a photographer, actually, no, we're not going to run from the blackness. We're going to indulge it, because we do not have to disclose ourselves to you in the entirety. We're going to embrace that blackness. It is a little bit related to Black is Beautiful, but now we're talking about photography. We're saying that heightening the tones of something is not the only way of intensifying its beauty. And in fact, inside the shadows can be tremendous excitement and tremendous subtlety and beauty. And that is what I saw in Roy DeCarava's work. And I think it's also connected to what people like Bradford Young, the cinematographer, does, but also an artist like Carrie Mae Weems, or, you know, any number of other artists in various ways. Kerry James Marshall is a painter, African-American painter, one of the great American artists currently at work. And he also does something with particularly black skin, of saying, this is in there somewhere, is something that is true of our experience.
Some of what you photograph is objects and things that are in rather controlled environments, but you also like to go out and shoot on the street.
That's right.
And I wonder...
Yeah, that's in my own practice as a photographer.
I wonder how your experience changes when you decide that you're going to go from just being part of whatever is taking place to then sort of making the choice to try to capture it or portray it in a particular situation, and if those two things feel very different to you.
Well, see, for me, there's really no big gap between life and writing and photography. Everything is a collaboration with chance. You woke up today and you had a general sense of the outline of your day, but you did not know exactly what would happen. You did not know, for example, that I would be saying these particular words to you, talking about how you woke up this morning not knowing what would happen. Mm-hmm. If you did know that and you were hearing those words again, you would have an unbearable sense of deja vu.
Right.
Right. So all of life is sort of this unexpected unfolding of things. And that's the way I approach literature. And that is exactly the way I approach photography. I say something will happen and I'm completely at home with not knowing what that thing might be. In fact, I mean, I came here for this interview because it's a busy afternoon. I'm not here this afternoon trying to take photos. However, I have brought my camera with me, and there's a construction site across the street that looks interesting, and I'll probably go there right after this conversation because that's what chance has given me, and it might turn out to be something I end up cherishing.
What tells you that you have found something that you want to capture?
You just know, right? I mean, there's almost a little thought that emanates from the scene towards you. And it's like a wink. It winks at you and says, there might be something here. You know, it comes from your experience in your art, but it also just sort of comes from being in that moment. Today we have bright sunshine in Dallas, and there are bright colors on that construction site. It looks complicated. It also connects to certain ideas I have about what Dallas is, a place of that is building, a place that is dynamic in a certain way, a place that has an industrial history. And so the scene winked at me, and I want to sort of go there and reciprocate. Like, you know, when somebody winks at you at a bar, if you're feeling them, you wink back. So I want to give some of that back. But how do you know? You guess, and hopefully it turns out. Who knows?
Do you already have your remarks planned for tonight? Do you know what you'll be talking about?
I know what I'll be talking about, but then I get up on stage, and there's a certain audience, and they are giving me something. And by the way, I should say it's a tremendous honor to be facing this audience here tonight and to be doing honor to one of the greatest of all, the people we've been privileged to share this planet with. What the audience gives me, I will respond to, but hopefully we'll be talking about what Martin Luther King can say to us about our sense of the international and what it means to look at things that might be thought to be none of our business. So calling us to a higher standard of involvement.
That conversation will take place tonight. The Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture is putting on a Martin Luther King Jr. symposium, and Heju Cole is a keynote speaker. His novels are Open City and Every Day is for the Thief. You can read his work at The New Yorker and The New York Times. He is also all over social media, and his website is hejucole.com. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
It's a tremendous privilege for me, and it was a joy. Thank you.